Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
It's October 1874 in Buffalo, New York, and Grover Cleveland has a problem. As a single, childless man, he works long hours and focuses on his career as a lawyer and politician. But his relationship with Maria Halpin has turned his world upside down. Last year, 33-year-old widow Halpin and 34-year-old bachelor Cleveland had a brief affair. She gave birth to a son shortly thereafter. Since then, Halpin has been caring for the child alone. Cleveland offers some financial support, but lately Halpin's been drinking the money away, to the point of neglecting the baby boy. In a small apartment in Buffalo, New York, Cleveland and Maria, her infant Oscar, and his friend Roswell Burroughs meet to discuss the situation. Halpin is crying. Cleveland tries to reason with her. "This is how it must be, Maria. I don't agree. I think we could be a family, you, me, and baby Oscar." No, I've told you before. "The best thing for the child is to put him up for adoption. This way he'll have a chance for a real family." Cleveland's perhaps harsh, detached answer convinces Maria that he will never marry her, nor offer anything more than financial support. As tears stream down her face, Cleveland's friend Burroughs, a county judge, chimes in.
"Don't worry, Maria. I have worked it all out for you and the child. You will go to Providence Asylum for a few months of rest. Once you are restored to full health, Cleveland here will help you set up shop in Niagara Falls."
"But what about my baby? Can I take him?"
Burroughs shakes his head.
"No, I'm afraid not. Young Oscar will go to the Protestant Orphan Asylum."
Cleveland jumps in. "Maria, I will pay the monthly fee until a respectable family can adopt the child. It'll work out." Looking from Cleveland to Burroughs and back to Cleveland, Halpin realizes she has no choice. She dries her tears and resigns herself to Burroughs' plan.
"Very well. Just give me a few minutes to gather Oscar's things and kiss him goodbye."
Cleveland sighs and nods in agreement. He's relieved that Halpin would go along with the plan. Other than Burroughs, a few detectives, and the staff at the asylum and the orphanage, no one ever needs to know that he got himself into what he calls a woman's scrape. Cleveland stands to leave the small apartment.
"Maria, you'll see. This arrangement will be the best thing for all of us, for Oscar, for you, and for me."
With that, he walks out the door. Less than an hour later, Burroughs, Halpin, and baby Oscar depart. Burroughs takes Halpin to the orphanage, and the grieving mother says a final farewell to her child. Cleveland's friend then escorts Halpin to the asylum, where she will spend several months recovering from her excessive drinking. Cleveland dutifully pays $5 per month to the orphanage until baby Oscar is adopted by a local family. When Halpin leaves the asylum, Cleveland sends her money to open a shop in Niagara Falls as promised. You will never see Halpin or the child again.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Wicked Game is sponsored by Factor. It's been a busy month for me. We launched a new podcast with another one coming soon, all while keeping six others that we work on going strong. So I'll be frank, it's been stressful and time-consuming. What could be a perfect storm of conditions to ruin my healthy eating habits? It's so easy to go grab drive-thru, right? But I didn't, because there's Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit. Chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door with over 35 different options every week to choose from, including keto, calorie smart, vegan, veggie, all the ways you want to eat healthy. And there's even more to enjoy with over 55 nutrition-packed add-ons that'll help make your weekly meal planning even more delicious. And I'm dead serious when I tell you they hit the spot. Not only are they tasty, but satisfying, something you don't often get in nutritious food. Plus, it's all ready in just 2 minutes. No prep, no mess. Perfect for your most busy, stressful times and all the rest, too. Head to factormeals.com/wickedgame50 and use code WICKEDGAME50 to get 50% off. That's code WICKEDGAME50 at factormeals.com/WICKEDGAME50 to get 50% off. From Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Elections Wicked Game. In the 1870s and 1880s, Grover Cleveland rose through the Democratic ranks. He earned a reputation as an honest, pro-reform civil servant in an era of quid pro quo machine politics. As he gained star power within the Democratic Party in New York, Cleveland earned the nickname Grover the Good. This reputation propelled him from mayor of Buffalo to governor of New York State in just a few years. Around this same time, on the other side of the aisle, there was another politician who made a name for himself too, Republican James Blaine. He served in Congress and as Secretary of State to President James Garfield. As a moderate Republican, Blaine lobbied to curb rampant federal patronage, better known as the spoils system. This system dated back to President Andrew Jackson, and by the mid-1880s, it had grown out of control. Many fully expected to turn their party loyalty into a lucrative government post, regardless of qualification. Moderate Republicans like Blaine sought to restore honesty, transparency, and efficiency to federal government departments. Another faction of Republicans, known as stalwarts, fought such reforms. Stalwarts were led by two men, Roscoe Conkling and his right-hand man, Vice President Chester Arthur. The spoils system had given them leverage within the party, and they saw no reason to rock the boat. Eager office seekers got caught in the middle of this intra-party debate. As Cleveland and Blaine argued for reform, and Conkling and Arthur resisted, one Republican, frustrated with business as usual in Washington, would exact his revenge on the President of the United States himself. This is episode 25, 1884. Blaine versus Cleveland. Tell the truth. Across the 1870s, Grover Cleveland had risen to prominence in Buffalo, New York. He had worked as a lawyer and, with the help of his well-connected uncle, established a law practice with a few partners. Cleveland had developed a close friendship with his partner, Oscar Folsom. Folsom's outgoing manner and good looks made a sharp contrast with Cleveland's dour countenance, so Folsom became the public face of their growing law practice. Cleveland was close with the entire Folsom family, but even the domestic bliss of Oscar and Emma Folsom could not entice Cleveland to marry and start a family of his own. When his sister asked if he had ever considered marriage, Cleveland replied, "A good many times, and the more I think of it, the more I think I'll not do it." Instead, Cleveland was married to his work. To use the modern parlance, he was a workaholic. His law practice had thrived, and he charged high fees for his in-demand services. Cleveland regularly sent large portions of his salary to his impoverished mother and single sisters. Business partners, clients, and local politicians respected him. One judge described Cleveland's honesty. He practiced no subterfuge. This was impossible for him. His great strength was his candor, his thorough integrity. In 1870, he had accepted the nomination to run for Erie County Sheriff. Though he was only 33 years old at the time, Cleveland had easily won the election and applied his knowledge of the law and work ethic to his post. He often chose to perform the unsavory parts of the job himself rather than force them onto an underling. When necessary, he had pulled the lever at the gallows and sent several men to their deaths. In 1873, Cleveland had left office and gone back to his private law practice, but he had never truly left politics behind. A devoted Democrat, Cleveland had supported local candidates and served on party committees. As the Democrats worked hard to overcome their reputation as the party of the rebellion in the Civil War, Cleveland had earned a reputation as a political booster in favor of reform. But Cleveland soon faced a public tragedy.
On July 23, 1875, his friend Oscar Folsom had a terrible carriage accident. On a balmy summer afternoon, Folsom rode in a carriage on his way to Cleveland's home. He had a love for carriage and horse racing. Relishing the speed of the ride, Folsom took a turn in the road too fast. His horse lost its footing. The wheel slipped and skidded, and the carriage careened out of control. Folsom was thrown from his seat and hit his head. He died instantly. 3 days later, on July 26, 1875, Cleveland was called on to give his friend's eulogy. As he looked out over the crowd of lawyers, friends, and family, Cleveland choked up. In the course of a life not entirely devoid of startling events, I can truly say I was never so shocked and overwhelmed as when I heard on Friday night of the death of Oscar Folsom. The congregants nodded in agreement. Tears streaked down the faces of several men, but Cleveland's sympathies focused on Folsom's widow, Emma, and her daughter, Frances. I know that we will sorely miss Oscar and his kind and generous heart, but let our tenderest sympathy extend to a fatherless child. After the memorial service, Cleveland followed his own advice. Folsom died without a will, and Cleveland took on the role of executor of his large estate. He managed the estate free of charge and assured that Emma and Frances Folsom were financially secure. Even with a large workload and his responsibilities in the Folsom estate, in 1881, Cleveland felt the lure of public office again. He told a friend, "This office seeking is a disease. It is even catching." In 1881, when Democratic Party leaders asked Cleveland to run for mayor of Buffalo, he agreed, and he won. In his acceptance speech, Cleveland firmly established his commitment to reform. He declared, "I believe that a more rigid scrutiny of all public expenditures will result in a great saving to the community. And when we consider that public officials are the trustees of the people and hold their places and exercise their power for the benefit of the people, there should be no higher inducement to a faithful and honest discharge of a public duty." Buffalo's citizens agreed, but not everyone approved of Cleveland's stance. Across the country, pro-reform moderate Republicans and Democrats hotly debated the necessity of government reform with the resistant, stalwart Republicans. That fierce debate set the table for an assassin to take matters into his own hands. It's 9 a.m. on Saturday, July 2nd, 1881. President James Garfield enters the waiting room of the Baltimore and Potomac Railway Depot in Washington, D.C. Garfield talks with his travel companion, Secretary of State James Blaine, about his summer plans. The two men take several steps into the bustling train station. They pass workmen and summer travelers on their way to board a train to New York City. The president does not see dark-haired Charles Guiteau waiting near the newsstand. As Garfield steps toward the train platform, Guiteau pulls out a pistol and takes aim. The bullet grazes the president's right shoulder, tearing his suit and shattering nearby glass, sending shards falling to the carpeted floor. Garfield looks around frantically for his attacker, while Guiteau takes advantage of the confusion. He steps to his right, aims his pistol again, and fires. This time, the bullet hits Garfield in the back, just above his waist. Garfield slumps to the floor as blood soaks the back of his light gray summer suit. Blaine watches in horror and calls out for help.
"Help! You there! Send for the nearest doctor! The president's been shot!"
As a crowd forms around the president, Guiteau attempts to slip away and head for the nearest exit, but a witness blocks his escape route. Guiteau is forced to turn and run to another door. He collides with a police officer, who grabs him by the arm, but doesn't know him as the assassin.
"Sir, you are coming from the scene of a shooting. I'm detaining you and all the rest until I get to the bottom of this."
As the officer forces Guiteau into a nearby chair, several train station employees bring a mattress from their workroom and lift the injured president onto it. Only then does Dr. Smith Townsend, Washington, D.C.'s health officer, arrive. He immediately begins examination of Garfield.
"Mr. President, can you tell me where you feel the most pain?" "My right leg and my foot ache." "That could be a sign of spinal damage. Mr. President, if you are able, can you turn over onto your side for me?"
Garfield winces as he rolls from his back to his side. Townsend carefully examines the gunshot wound, probing it with his finger in an attempt to locate the bullet.
"Oh, God, what do you think of my condition, doctor?"
"Mr. President, you are gravely injured, but I can see no spinal damage and I have no reason to fear the worst."
But Dr. Townsend's encouragement does not assuage the president.
No, no, doctor. I feel I am a dead man.
After Gateau's attack, President James Garfield lingered for 86 days before dying from septicemia or blood poisoning. Gateau ultimately admitted to the murder, claiming that Garfield passed him over for a government position he deserved. Garfield died on September 19, 1881 at 10:35 p.m. Chester A. Arthur was never supposed to be president. He became vice president only because, as a stalwart Republican, he brought votes from that wing of the party to his running mate, James Garfield. He also hailed from New York and could almost guarantee that crucial state would vote for the Garfield-Arthur ticket in the 1880 election. But moderate Republicans never wanted him at the helm. Many of them considered Arthur to be a political hack in the pocket of the powerful and corrupt stalwart Republican leader, Roscoe Conkling. One Republican, 31-year-old Julia Sand, took action. Though she had no personal connection to Arthur, she boldly wrote to the prospective president, "The people are bowed in grief, but not so much because Garfield is dying, as because you are his successor." But Sand saw a reason for hope and offered Arthur some wise counsel. Making a man president can change him. Great emergencies awaken generous traits which have lain dormant half a life. If there is a spark of true nobility in you, now is the occasion to let it shine. At 2:15 a.m. on September 20th, 1881, Arthur took the oath of office and became president. He took Sand's advice to heart and tried to act with his conscience. With President Garfield's assassination, Arthur began to see the need for reform. A frustrated office seeker had murdered his predecessor, and Arthur came to think civil service reform could solve many of the problems caused by the spoil system. Again, Sand wrote to Arthur, "The vital question before the country today is civil service reform. The vital question before you is how you will meet it." Arthur began writing back to Sand regularly, asking for advice. He needed her support as he faced national challenges that had been brewing for years. As he navigated increasingly difficult political issues and sought to make the presidency his own, Arthur would alienate members from both wings of the Republican Party. He would find himself with few allies and even fewer friends. The topic that would ultimately drive a wedge between Arthur and his party was a hot-button issue that, in one form or another, has been with the country since its inception: immigration. Wicked Game is sponsored by NetSuite. Here's some quick and easy math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more profit you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more these days. So to reduce costs and the headaches associated with them, switch to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. And with NetSuite, you'll also reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud, no hardware required, and accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math for yourself. See how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/elections. That's netsuite.com/elections. netsuite.com/elections. If you're a careful Wicked Game listener, you know in the credits, I mentioned my friend Professor Greg Jackson and his podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. It's a great show. But one way it can doesn't suck even more is when you listen to it without ads. You can listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game, all episodes of History That Doesn't Suck, and all episodes of many more great history podcasts without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. History That Doesn't Suck is a deeply researched chronological survey of American history from a trained academic who also knows how to tell a story. Plus, in addition to ad-free listening to one of the best American history podcasts out there, you get scores of bonus episodes at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. For decades, Californians had blamed Chinese immigrants for depressing wages, and had passed several laws to restrict their rights. But fear of Chinese immigrants had first become a national issue in 1879, when a factory in Pennsylvania used Chinese laborers to bust a strike of white workers. This incident had fueled racist attitudes, and in March of 1882, Republicans and Democrats in Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. The bill barred all Chinese laborers from entering the country for 20 years. It also prevented any Chinese person currently living in the U.S. from leaving and then re-entering the country for any reason. Since most Chinese immigrants were married men, sending their wages home to their wives and children in China, they often left the country to visit their families. The re-entry ban effectively made them choose between supporting their families or having the chance to see them again. Chester A. Arthur thought this legislation went too far. So did his correspondent, Sand. She wrote, "A Congress of ignorant schoolboys could not devise more idiotic legislation. It is not only behind the age, but opposed to the spirit of American institutions." So Arthur vetoed the bill on April 4, 1882. The president acknowledged that an 1880 treaty with China allowed the U.S. to limit Chinese immigration, but he argued that the 20-year ban was a breach of our national faith with China and would likely have a negative impact on trade. A few people praised Arthur's bold stand for American principles. The New York Times lauded the president's firmness and wisdom, but the Times didn't represent most Americans' views. Congress reworked the Chinese Exclusion Act. They lowered the immigration ban from 20 to 10 years, but kept the re-entry moratorium in place. Ultimately, Arthur caved to public pressure. He signed this barely changed version of the Chinese Exclusion Act on May 6, 1882. Only a few months later, Congress passed the River and Harbor Bill. This pork barrel bill purported to fund improvement projects for lighthouses and river navigation systems across the United States. But congressmen used it to funnel federal money to their own districts, boosting their chances for re-election and quietly pocketing any extra cash. Arthur saw right through the charade. He vetoed this bill on August 1, 1882. This move, though, improved his image with the American people, but made nearly every congressman his enemy. They overturned his veto only a few weeks later. These two failed vetoes caused Arthur to lose face within his party. His principled stands upset stalwart Republicans who wanted him to toe the party line. Stalwarts wanted to protect machine politics and the traditional backroom deals that had given them their power. They argued that the patronage system, where party leaders gave out government positions as rewards to loyal party members, worked. And though Arthur had been a loyal, stalwart Republican nearly his entire political career, as his presidency wore on, he sided more and more with reformers like Senator George Hunt Pendleton. In 1883, Senator Pendleton introduced a civil service reform bill. Pendleton argued that applicants for government positions should take an exam and only those with the highest scores should be hired. He also called for promotions based on merit. The reform bill had its limits. It only applied to about 10% of federal jobs, and Senator Pendleton knew this. But he reasoned, "The fact is patent that President Garfield's assassin Guiteau wanted an office and did not get it, and he believed the president was responsible for his failure. We must supplant this system with the idea that public offices are public trusts to be administered solely for the public good." President Arthur saw the merits of this argument, and when he signed the Pendleton Civil Service Reform Act on January 16, 1883, he solidified his reputation as a reformer. But the move left Arthur politically out in the cold. Moderate, pro-reform Republicans still didn't trust him, and anti-reform stalwart Republicans felt he had betrayed them. So Arthur decided to make his case directly to the people. By late May, President Arthur realized that he badly needed a political win. So on May 24, 1883, in an effort to galvanize the people to his side, he attended the dedication for the recently built Brooklyn and New York Bridge, glad-handing locals and charming the crowd. He was hoping to use the event to shore up support for his presidency, but his hopes were dashed. Days after his tour, tragedy would strike. On Wednesday, May 30th, Memorial Day, thousands of citizens toured the new Brooklyn and New York Bridge. The engineering marvel stretched 1,594 feet across the East River, connecting Manhattan to Brooklyn. Though the official dedication was 6 days earlier, American flags still waved from shipping wharves on both sides of the river, and houses displayed red, white, and blue bunting. By midday, there were around 15,000 people crowding the walkways, but only 24 policemen on hand to direct traffic. When a woman, pressed on by the crowd, fell down a flight of stairs, a stampede of terrified Americans ensued. The crush left dozens wounded and 12 people dead. The Brooklyn Bridge stampede occurred only 6 days after President Arthur had toured the bridge, and the tragedy overshadowed the desperately needed political points he hoped to garner with his visit. Arthur's backers, too, knew he needed something to bolster his popularity, because as the presidential election approached, President Arthur had few people in his corner. In 1884, only a small contingent of loyal friends were willing to put forward Arthur's name at the upcoming Republican presidential nominating convention. A wealthy ally even offered to bring $100,000 to the convention, over $2.6 million today, to buy votes for Arthur. But Arthur wasn't interested. As he explained, "I do not want to be nominated as the result of any political manipulation. I want a nomination that will reflect the desire of the party or none at all." It seemed that Arthur's transformation from a political politician to reformer was complete. Arthur bowed out of the presidential race through inaction. On June 2, 1884, Republicans gathered in Chicago. Party leaders would not select current President Chester Arthur. He had abandoned anti-reform stalwart Republicans, and moderate Republicans didn't believe his pro-reform attitude was permanent. When they debated whom they should nominate in his place, one name floated to the surface: former Secretary of State and current Speaker of the House, James Blaine. Blaine also supported civil service reform. He had supported it before Garfield's assassination. But Blaine's name was tainted. He had been involved with one too many scandals in his long political career, and many Republicans mistrusted him. However, no other Republican had enough clout to beat Blaine's resume, voter base, and charisma. On June 6, Blaine received the party's nomination with Senator John Logan as his running mate. A large faction of Republicans was dismayed by this decision. A reporter asked New York State Representative Theodore Roosevelt if he would support Blaine. Roosevelt responded, "It is a subject I do not care to talk about. Rather than vote for Blaine, I would give hearty support to any decent Democrat." Most Democrats weren't aware of the fractiousness in the Republican Party. They were focused on finding a strong candidate for themselves, and their eyes turned to Grover Cleveland. Since 1882, Grover Cleveland had been serving as governor of New York and serving well. The lawyer-turned-politician had brought his honesty with him to Albany, becoming a champion for many key reforms. So in early 1884, a few New York politicians had suggested to Cleveland that he could win the Democratic nomination for president. He gruffly replied, "Go away, boys. You're always trying to get me into a scrape." But Cleveland fit the Democrats' bill. He was an honest man with a short and scandal-free political career. The Democratic nominating convention opened on July 7, 1884 in Chicago. In almost every nominating speech, politicians referenced tariffs, the only political issue that distinguished them from the Republicans. But one fed-up Cleveland supporter cried out, "To hell with the tariff, tariff be damned. We want to win this fight. We want a man to win it with." On July 11th, Democrats found that man. Cleveland won his party's nomination with Thomas Hendricks as his running mate. Cleveland didn't attend the convention. He got a telephone call in the governor's office in New York that afternoon. As he listened to the news of his nomination, his face brightened. "By Jove, that is something, isn't it?" Most Democrats were thrilled to back a reform-minded candidate. When explaining why the Wisconsin delegation voted for Cleveland, one Democrat said, "They love him for the enemies he has made." Others took a more disinterested view. They argued that Cleveland won the nomination because he hailed from the most important swing state, New York. They predicted that he would make a good president, but not be an active reformer. As one Democrat delegate surmised, "Looking the thing square in the face, there can be no genuine anti-monopoly victory this year." As the campaign got underway, Democrat Cleveland had a reputation for honesty and a unified party in his corner. Republican James Blaine had name recognition and decades of political experience in his. However, this presidential campaign wouldn't focus on party platforms or candidate qualifications. The fight between Blaine and Cleveland would be personal. It's July 21st, 1884, in Albany, New York. Cleveland works in his office, fulfilling his duties as governor, while Democratic Party leaders run his presidential campaign. A few days ago, the governor approved his campaign slogan, "Public office is a public trust."
This pithy statement is a boiled-down version of a sentiment Cleveland has expressed many times, but it's about to be severely tested. An aide walks into Cleveland's office and puts the Buffalo Telegraph newspaper on his desk.
What's this? You should read it, sir, but I don't think you'll like it.
Cleveland glances at the headline. A terrible tale. A dark chapter in a public man's history. The pitiful story of Maria Halpin and Governor Cleveland's son. Cleveland goes pale.
What is this? I'm not sure, sir, but it's given our friends cause for concern.
Cleveland reads the story while his assistant stands nervously by. The governor groans and shakes his head as he reads the exaggerated version of his relationship with Maria Halpin. The article asserts that Cleveland promised to marry Halpin. It also claims that Cleveland abandoned the child and had Halpin committed to an insane asylum. To further smear his character, the article reports that while mayor of Buffalo, Cleveland ran a harem out of his house. Cleveland throws the paper down on his desk. His aide looks sheepish.
How should we proceed, sir? I'm not sure. Let me think on it. This story is just in the Telegraph, so who would believe anything printed in that rag? We've had phone calls, sir. Yes, and? The story is also printed in the Boston Journal, and several other newspapers have committed to printing it tomorrow.
Cleveland sighs in despair. A sordid tale printed in a tabloid that's never supported him is one thing. A scandal appearing in a reputable source like the Boston Journal is another.
Well, sir, we could retaliate. There is a rumor that Blaine only married his wife at the point of his father-in-law's shotgun.
The assistant hands Cleveland a write-up of the Blaine story. Cleveland glances at it, and he tears it up and throws the scraps in the fireplace.
No, we will not print such a story. The other side can have the monopoly of all the dirt in this campaign.
Well then, sir, how should we proceed?
Whatever you do, tell the truth.
Cleveland supporters followed his bold advice. They answered the claims made in the Telegraph story. In an editorial that circulated widely, Reverend Kinsey Twining wrote, "Cleveland was guilty of an illicit connection, but the charge as brought against him lacks the elements of truth in these substantial points. There is no seduction, no adultery, no breach of promise, no obligation of marriage." Still, the Maria Halpin scandal would not go away. Even though Blaine had a marriage scandal of his own, Republicans pushed the Halpin story and did their best to use it to tarnish Cleveland's reputation. The attacks against Cleveland would be relentless, and they would escalate. Late in the campaign, Republicans would deliver an October surprise. But in the end, the ploy would backfire, and the Republicans would be left defending themselves against a scandal of their own making.
Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game without interruption by subscribing at IntoHistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also all ad-free, like Wild West Extravaganza, a journey back to the fascinating, tumultuous, and often violent world of the American Old West. From famous outlaws like Billy the Kid and Jesse James to lawmen like Wyatt Earp and Wild Bill Hickok to trailblazing pioneers and frontiersmen, Wild West Extravaganza tells the true stories of the real-life characters who shaped this iconic era. So saddle up and discover the true history of the American frontier, the good, the bad, and the ugly, ad-free at IntoHistory.com.
How do you solve a crime in reverse when you believe that someone was murdered but have no clue who the victim was?
We have to do our job, and we have to find out who did they kill? If it's possible, how are we going to do that?
I'm Jake Halpern, and this is Deep Cover, The Nameless Man. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the 1884 contest, the platforms of the Republican and Democratic parties were toothless. Afraid to tackle the complex social issues of the day, both parties tried their best not to make waves. Their domestic and international policies were insipid. There was almost no discernible difference between the two platforms, except on the issue of tariffs. Republicans argued for a high tariff to protect American workers. Democrats wanted a lower tariff that would protect nascent American industries, but not create a budget surplus in Washington, D.C. Both parties favored the Chinese exclusion policy, and neither acknowledged the rampant racism preventing Black Americans from exercising their right to vote. Cleveland and Blaine followed their party lines without flinching. With no real policy issues to distinguish them, both campaigns resorted to mudslinging. Cleveland's scandal erupted early, but Blaine brought baggage into the election as well. 8 years prior, in the 1876 election, Blaine had lost out on the presidential nomination due to an allegation that he accepted a $64,000 bribe from the Union Pacific Railroad. Blaine had denied it, but James Mulligan, a former employee of Blaine's brother-in-law, had letters from Blaine proving the truth of the story. Anti-Blaine Republicans, known as mugwumps, convinced Mulligan to publish his letters in September of 1884. One letter ended with the damning phrase, "Burn, burn, burn this letter." This seemed to prove that Blaine really had accepted a bribe all those years ago and had asked his friends to cover for him. Democrats added it to their catchy anti-Blaine slogan, "Blaine, Blaine, the continental liar from the state of Maine, burn this letter." The campaign got even uglier. The satirical magazine Puck published a series of cartoons that mocked Blaine. One depicted him covered with tattoos of his many political crimes. Readers could clearly see Blaine standing nearly naked, covered in words like Mulligan letters, corruption, and demagogism. Another cartoon portrayed Blaine as a magnet, attracting incoming scandals. But Cleveland wasn't immune from similar barbed attacks. Newspapers published a cartoon that showed him covering his ears as he walked past a crying mother and baby. The baby called out, "I want my paw," a clear reference to Cleveland's treatment of Maria Halpin and their baby boy. At rallies and political events, exultant Republicans chanted, "Ma, ma, where's my paw?" But Cleveland supporters had an easier time explaining away his actions than Blaine supporters. And so, unlike Cleveland, Blaine had to take matters into his own hands. In October, while Cleveland worked in Albany and allowed party leaders to manage his campaign, Blaine traveled across the United States and made his case directly to the people. In 1 3-week period, he made 400 speeches. Blaine ended his tour in New York City, in a critical electoral state that would likely decide the outcome of the contest. Cleveland was also a native New Yorker, and that gave him a clear advantage over Blaine, a Maine outsider. To win the state, Blaine knew he needed to make a splash in New York City, so he leaned on local ministers to help him get his message to their congregants. In late October 1884, one of those ministers, a Presbyterian reverend named Samuel Burchard, would speak at a rally on Blaine's behalf. But with three simple words, he would undo all of Blaine's hard work and turn his campaign on its head. It's October 29th, 1884, at the Fifth Avenue Hotel in Manhattan. A large crowd of religious leaders had gathered in support of Republican nominee James Blaine, who sits at the dais on stage, waiting for the rally to begin. In the large convention hall, there are hundreds of ministers, a handful of Catholic priests, even a rabbi, not to mention a large gaggle of reporters. Among them is a reporter named Frank Mack, a writer for the Associated Press. He turns to the man to his left, his stenographer. "Blaine seems calm and collected, don't you think? Confident, even." "Well, of course he's confident. Didn't you read the papers?" Earlier in the day, Republicans made a splash in the tabloids when they published an affidavit from Maria Halpin claiming that she was raped by Grover Cleveland. That's not real reporting. Besides, I don't think people care about salacious stories like that." Blaine's supporters disagree, Frank. "You think it's a coincidence Halpin's affidavit surfaces on the same day Blaine makes a speech in front of this crowd?" "Well, no, it's not a coincidence. You'll hear no argument from me there." With Halpin's affidavit and the support of these ministers, Blaine's supporters are hoping to deliver Cleveland's candidacy a death blow. Frank cuts his eyes at James Blaine, who joins the crowd in a chorus of applause as the presiding officer of the rally, Reverend Samuel Burchard, takes the podium. After making a short introduction, Burchard folds up his prepared remarks, places them in his pocket, and turns to address James Blaine. The Reverend speaks from the heart.
"We are Republicans. We don't propose to leave our party. We don't identify ourselves with a party whose antecedents have been rum, Romanism, and rebellion."
The hall, filled with applause and elation just moments before, falls deathly quiet. Frank Mack can't believe his ears. By using the phrase rum, Romanism, and rebellion, Burchard has made a serious mistake. Rum is a stab at anyone who doesn't support prohibition. Romanism is an anti-immigrant shot at the Democratic Party's ties to the Roman Catholic Irish immigrant community, and it reeks of nativism. Rebellion is an attempt to lay the blame for the Civil War at the Democrats' feet. It's an antiquated line of attack. The Democrats who supported secession are, for the most part, no longer in power. The idea that Grover Cleveland, a native New Yorker, is sympathetic to the Confederacy is ridiculous and insulting to many in the crowd. As Burchard tries to continue, his words are engulfed with a chorus of boos and hisses emanating from the hall.
We are loyal to our flag and loyal to you.
As Burchard's speech goes entirely off the rails, Frank leans over to his stenographer.
Did you get that?
The stenographer replies with a smirk.
I did, you old fool.
James Blaine had hoped that this gathering of ministers would give his candidacy a last-minute boost. Coupled with the bombshell Halpin affidavit, Blaine had hoped this event would rally the people of New York to his side. Instead, the words spoken by Reverend Samuel Birch a mere 6 days before Election Day swallowed Blaine's candidacy whole. After Burchard's speech, many men in the crowd look murderous. In his impromptu alliteration, Burchard undid almost all of Blaine's hard campaign work. His words were seen as bigoted, nativist, and insensitive to prudence. Very few people applauded as Blaine took the podium after Burchard. But Blaine didn't know what was wrong. He hadn't heard or wasn't paying attention to Burchard's words. So he delivered his scripted remarks without distancing himself from Burchard's offensive comments. The official stenographer left before a campaign leader could expunge the reverend's words from the record. And a few hours later, Democratic newspaper editor Arthur Gorman received a copy of Reverend Burchard's speech. He immediately published it. Noting Blaine's lack of rebuttal, Gorman gloated, "If anything will elect Cleveland, these words will do it." On November 4, 1884, Americans went to the polls. As expected, the southern states voted solidly for the Democrat Cleveland. Blaine carried the West and Midwest. But the real contest, as expected, was in New York. Heavy rains pounded the Empire State on Election Day. This kept many rural Republican voters in upstate New York from traveling to their polling stations. City dwellers, mostly Democrats, had an easier time casting their ballots. And when the votes were counted, Cleveland won by a razor-thin margin, beating Blaine by only 1,047 votes. But it was enough to give all of New York's 36 electoral votes to Cleveland. Cleveland garnered 219 electoral votes and the majority of the popular vote. He owed his success to a few key factors. First, the election focused on personal background and scandals instead of pertinent political issues. Though the Maria Halpin affair was a large stain on his record, Cleveland was a more appealing choice than the scandal-ridden Blaine. The second, the Republican mugwumps, who made every effort to discredit Blaine, probably pushed public opinion towards Cleveland. And lastly, Cleveland's own reputation as a reformer gave him a boost. People were not just against Blaine, they were voting for Cleveland and his brand of pro-reform politics. And so elected, Cleveland resolved to bring with him to Washington the best men the Democratic Party had to offer. He would not play favorites or dole out favors. He told a confidant, "Henceforth, I must have no friends." On March 4, 1885, Grover Cleveland became the first Democrat to take the oath of office since before the Civil War. True to his word, Cleveland would strive for a transparent administration and work to reduce patronage in the Capitol. But his term in office would be marred by violent social unrest. This is episode 25 of American Elections Wicked Game, 1884, Tell the Truth. On the next episode, the election of 1888, as social unrest rocks the nation and threatens Grover Cleveland's chances for a second term, Cleveland faces off against the grandson of a former president, a deft campaigner, and a rising star in the Republican Party, Benjamin Harrison. Icebergs, jagged rocks and rocky straits, mutinies, misfortune, and broadside battles. There are more tales of the sea than survivors to tell them, but the podcast Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is doing a good job, and you can listen to all episodes of that podcast plus many others, including American Election's Wicked Game, without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is one of my favorites from last year, a podcast about the greatest mishaps, misfortune, and misadventures of the sea. You'll hear stories of corruption, greed, bad intentions, and just plain horrible decision-making that resulted in some of the worst maritime disasters from all over the world. And some of these are more recent than you think. All episodes are ad-free, including bonus content and more, at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Election's Wicked Game is an Airship production, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. Co-executive produced by Stephen Walters in association with Ritual Productions. Written and researched by C.L. Salazar. Fact-checking by Greg Jackson from the podcast History That Doesn't Suck.